Anthony, can I sit next to you? Is there someone sitting there? I am sitting there now.
We're good.
Do you want to come through here?
Whatever you do not kick over my tea.
Thousands of years ago.
Matthew. Professor Rieger, Professor Jordan, and I'm Elam Ely. My job is simply to be the moderator, and I'm going to tell you essentially how things work, and then I'll referee as needed. There is a microphone right there that I will recognize one student at a time to ask a question related to singing. It's not related to repertoire. It's related to singing in the way that we would consider our bodies, our minds, our spirits, our expressiveness, our personalities coming together and create sounds with our voice that carry the art of music. So that's the biggest umbrella I could control over this. First of all, some of us have very brief statements to make about singing. So I've toyed with some words. It's about singing and teaching. But it's also about vocal technique. In my own statement, I will just describe vocal technique as choices that you learn to make with your voice teacher to supplement the talent that you already have. Okay, they're not to replace things necessarily, unless it's badly learned method, right? But it is up to the individual student and their senior vocal advisor, their voice teacher, to develop a vocal technique that allows you to be a contributing member and a strong presence anywhere you choose to sing. It's up to you to put it together. And so that's essential. And so what you'll be getting today is, in some case, information, new viewpoints. I think there's a great unity among us about what we value in singing. We want it to be integrated. We want it to be dynamically engaged, not passive, not tense in terms of losing possibilities. But everything we could say about breath management, diction, articulation, musical energy, anything that we would say that helps you to be a better singer is what we want to do. And today we'll give you some insights that in some cases are different than what you've already heard, and in many cases you'll hear a lot of similar perspective. So there's nothing else really that I want to say in detail. I might give an answer or two along the way, so I'm going to exclude myself. Would any of you like to make a brief statement at all? You are? We went right to the top.
Traditions and legacies of many, many years of wonderful teaching methodologies that have come down. kind of my role here, that, you know, what I wanted to do was to preserve this wonderful art and this wonderful tradition of moving people into careers they may not even have imagined. So some of you undergrads who take this science, you discover that whole world. And next time I know you're in the lab asking if you can do a little bit more work in there. The grad students are going into doctoral programs in research and in many other kinds of fields, of course. All the performance fields are so important. I sort of did more of first because I would thought so much about performance, and I'm 100% a performer. But I wanted to say lastly, I had a poem this week that really meant a whole lot to me. I shared it on Facebook, so those of you who are on Facebook, friends, aren't good. But I realized how teaching and performing both involve risk. They involve putting yourself out there. They involve being vulnerable in front of other people. And that's the way that we touch other people. That's the way we meet other people. That's the way we teach others. And so the end of this poem, I just want to read it. It's called "I Will Not Die an Unlived Life" by Donna Markova. Some of you may have heard it. It's very short. I'm just reading the end. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. So if we are the seeds, you are the blossoms and possibly the next generations of fruit. Or perhaps we're the blossoms because the seed was planted so long ago and you all are the fruit. But let's grow a great big garden that involves Westminster Park.
Throat. I know the name just masterclass person. And Ego Teak say I have the straw in the water, vocalizing that way. I've given that to some of my professional students, and they felt so much better. And there's an Alexander exercise that I give my students called the whispered ah. And you can Google it, and you'll see this California guy talking about the whispered ah. And it's meant for people, normal people, not us, normal people, to lead themselves a magnet object. So that might be good for us too. And you can find it, and you can practice without phonating through the whispered ah. You can still have a legitimate practice session and not phoning at all. There's certain medications that you can find that help with vocal swelling. And I know that Dr. Price and Dr. Arneson can speak to those. But I get that a lot. Vocal rest is important. It's also important that you know that what we're doing, the type of practice we're doing, you're practicing for your brain, not your throat. This type of repetitive practice that I want my students to do, a la the practicing mind, a la the talent code. You're practicing for your brain to remember to do physical things, very much like pro athletes need to do. So it's important that you practice in short sessions, that you don't go and sing for an hour without any kind of focus to it, that you're focusing on a sensation and repeating it. And that kind of practice will help you, especially when you get fatigued, to if you have one thing, if you have a breathing exercise you've learned that doesn't require phonation, you can practice that and then your brain's going to remember to do it. So that's my one thing that I can say.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I guess I'll say something. Of course, it's also important to realize what brought you to that point of being fatigued. That there are things, you know, because of the normal schedule of singing we have here, and then there are things in your own life and your own schedule. I know many of you don't suffer from a lack of wanting to do things. You would think that classwork and parts of the curriculum are enough, but you all get involved in a lot of other things. So it is important to know that it's not so crucial to have every hour of the day and night scheduled to do something. And I'm listening to myself talk, and I'm preaching to myself too, that there are unique times where possible to let some of these things that we've learned sink in. And I do think it's because of our culture today. You're all spending a lot of money to come here. You want to get the most out of your education here. And sometimes that becomes almost too all-encompassing. So take some time out and really think about your whole week and make sure you not just leave time for practicing, but leave time in your week to sit down and think about what you've learned, not only in voice, but everything.
You think that I can remember something when I said we're doing something with your brain? Yeah, no. So, apparently, the brain needs 8 hours of sleep in order to remember physical activity. Okay, everybody laugh. Who gets 8 hours of sleep? I understand that pro athletes, there's the Denver Broncos, one of the teams have been told to wear sleep masks at night, so that they can get a good 8 hours of sleep. I've started wearing a sleep mask, and it actually does work. It kind of shuts out any of the light that might be in the room. So you need sleep. Sleep helps with that you can remember things, and unlike what I just didn't remember.
And I'll just add to that, at your ages, if you are in your late teens or early 20s, which most of you are, many of you are, doctors actually say you need 9.5 hours of sleep a night. But it's so unrealistic, isn't it, unfortunately. But that tells you, if you subtract from that how many hours you actually get, that the deficit which you often working. And so a vocal nap during the day, which is a 20 to 30 minute period of absolute silence, will help you. Don't whisper, don't hopefully cough. Just isolate yourself for a while. Go to the library. You know, read, do some, or take an actual nap. That would be great too. And of course, you know, hydrate. But remember, the water you drink today serves you tomorrow. It has to go through your system. So if you're performing tomorrow, you should be drinking a lot today. All of you are rehearsing constantly, so really just up your water intake.
I think
one
thing that leads to more vocal fatigue is that if we sing and perhaps so much and so mindlessly at times, that we lose the sense of physical suspension and buoyancy. And when we do that, you're just putting extra pressure and weight right on your vocal folds, even if you're singing lightly. So that's part of the, if it's worth doing, you really better awaken your whole body to give it a sense of support and suspension. That's really, really. One thing in terms of rest that I always remember an interview with Larry Hagman, the actor, years ago, who was not a singer, his mother was very important, right? But he observed strictly a vocal Sabbath on daily. And I asked my students to do that, and you know, it can't be Sunday normally in a church bar, so probably leave Saturday. That you really should at least not sing, and maybe even preferably don't talk. You know, that's really severe, but it makes sense, and so that ought to be woven into our consciousness. Other comments about that question? We have another question.
Important in creating a system for studying. And those of you with whom I've crossed paths have heard me speak ad nauseum about these three silos that we need to work in. There's a way we prepare, and a way we explore, and then from exploration there is editing, and there are choices we make that become the performance. So I think the beautiful work that you're talking about in finding a personal connection to the stories that we're entrusted to tell belongs in a certain silo, and that's in the exploration. And so that deepens how you explore the piece, and it informs a performance, but it's not the heart of the performance. So I think there's a time when you relate to things personally and explore all of those things that make us so vulnerable and make us so human in the moment, but gain perspective with relationship to our own personal lives before we perform. So for example, there are things also that we shouldn't use. The great acting teacher Lee Strasberg used to say, you can't use anything that's 7 years, unless it's 7 years away. Well, you're too young. You wouldn't have any experiences. So, or very few. So it's hard to do that. But I know the most profound things in my own life I can't use. For example, my father's death. And I, in my work, I'm always dying or somebody else is dying. So it was the most immediate thing to go to ground or personalize and bring a piece of Nova to what was happening. But every time I did it, it hijacked the character's story. So that's something, as profound as it is in my life, that I can't use, because then the moment is contaminated, for lack of a better word, rather than informed. So I think, and you're doing such beautiful work with this, and your own work as an actor now, that you fully explore during a time in your process, but that's not necessarily how you perform. And so dividing your work and strategies into those three silos, I feel, gives us the chance for connection without connection hijacking the moment.
I'd like to speak to that too. I'm going to use the microphone because I'm going to save my voice.
I don't have to.
Authenticity in our sound. And when I'm listening to a singer and I'm listening to somebody one-on-one, I'm looking and listening for ballots. Ballots of the sound. You may have heard the term chiaroscuro, that we want to hear brightness and we want to hear darkness. We want to hear its center and balance of the sound. And sometimes that involves going deep internally and emotionally, and to find an authentic sound can sometimes be scary. And I had this experience with one of the wonderful soprano that I work with when I go to teach at the Washington National Opera, who just welled up in tears when she found the oscuro part of her sound. And there was this, she was overwhelmed with emotion because of the sound she was making and how it resonated with her soul. And you know, that's hard to find. And it's that, and that's in that moment, in that one-on-one lesson. That's a profound moment when you can find that and trust it, and it's hard to trust that. And I think that's a little bit where you're coming from. You know, the performing part of it, we got to know just how deep we can go when we are moved, but not so much moved that we fall apart.
Others? Is that a question?
So there's a statement by Longfellow in the novel Hyperion, it says the human voice is the organ of the soul. And I think that means that we have a big responsibility as singers. But it's also our great opportunity. So it's both responsibility and opportunity. That means it's going to carry with it a lot of stuff that we have to get through. To be authentic means you have to face some of your fears. You have to face your humanity. But that's the opportunity to become a fully engaged, whole human being. And when you hear great singing, you know that these are great human beings that have learned something about themselves in the process of learning singing. So it is challenging, and it is scary, and it is important to work for the development of our own souls, because our voices are organs of our souls.
Great advice. I, along those lines, we just to push what some of you might think is the guilt button. Not only is it true that with responsibility comes the power to perform, as the sense of what he was just talking about, but you're at a place now where you have such opportunity to put things together, and you won't be here forever. Some people do, but you really need to take advantage of this, and don't do just the things that are fun at the moment, and don't do just the things that you do so well because you feel boosted by that. And so make the hard choices to demand and expect more, and by choosing to do something, sometimes it means not doing something else. And when I said earlier that it's up to you to put it together, that's a part of that dynamic. And that's also obviously part of what the fatigue factor is. So you really have a great opportunity, and for being here today, for example, I hope that, and I would think that this time will have an important part in your consciousness moving on about how to sing, how to teach sing. I really do. I wish I'd had this kind of opportunity when I was in college. Right.
I just want to follow. Zach, let's follow up. Then Zach. After Zach. After Zach.
To add to that.
Okay.
just to adding to the fear factor, for me, some of my biggest moments were making the mistakes and learning from them. We are not perfect. I don't care what you say. The only time you're going to be perfect is if they put you on a recording and they tune everything up and do all of that. And that is no fun, because it is coming from us. So don't be afraid of cracking a note or something really. Please, learn from that mistake, because it's out of all the things that we're doing, being afraid of researching all of this stuff, it's fun. Knowing what I know now, I do it all over again, and then what? So learn from those mistakes and have fun with it too.
That was exactly what I was going to say. Great minds, great minds. No, is that I think part of our hesitancy in being involved with our own truth and our personal relationship to the music that we're inhabiting is that it might keep us from being perfect. And that's not what I mean as a contamination. That's not it. Perfection is so binary. It's boring. I love a great acting teacher and director, Wesley Ball, says that we're all on this helix all the time. This strand, getting better, working, trying to reach perfection. That's part of the artistic DNA. But that for performances, you have to step off the spiral and just say, this is where I am today, warts and all, what's good, what's bad, and I'm going to tell the truth from this spot. And then the performance is over, and you get back on the spiral and get better and better and better. So I don't want us to confuse our opportunity to be truthful and present with perfection. It has nothing to do with it.
Excellent. Yes.
Could I just, this is, forgive my language, but you all know me, so.
just pronounce it well.
I often quote Charlie Parker. He once said, master your instrument, master the music, and then just forget that bullshit and play.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
About what happens when you get into that state. you think about the physical experiences that you have in that moment, generally those adrenaline rushes have to do with the sympathetic nervous system and the side of your nervous system that is the fight or flight response, which is part of your lizard brain that is there to keep you safe in danger. So when you perceive danger, we used to live out in nature and there used to be real dangers, leopards and snakes and, you know, many all kinds of natural things that would challenge our existence. That was there to protect us. But now we don't have that. Now we live in, you know, isolated buildings and we've basically kept ourselves, we've eliminated a lot of those challenges. So now we have things like stress and performance anxiety that are danger moments. So when that happens, typically your body systems shut down a little bit and you tend to disconnect from the sense of your lower body and everything sort of floats up above and everything cools in your brain and you get confused and it's the fight or flight response. You're either going to run, fight, or freeze. So what I work with with singers in this moment is, when we're talking about this, is identifying where in the body you feel the blockages, where you feel the tension, where you feel the disconnect from the lower body, especially. It might be here, it might be in the ribs around the kidneys, it might be down around the sacrum, the hips, and it might be in your legs or your feet. And then using techniques through yoga and through these more mindful techniques and using the breath to reconnect into that part of the body. The other thing that happens when you get into that fight or flight response is that your breath shortens and it cools up and you stop exhaling, which is very difficult when you sing. Right? So if you get frozen in the exhalation phase and you hold your breath, right? And so the quickest antidote is to exhale and to lengthen your exhalation. Because the longer you think your exhalation, that actually ties to your and stimulates your parasympathetic nervous response, which is the calming side of your nervous system. So they balance out. And by singing, actually singing, as a rule, should be a calming experience. Because it's lengthening your exhalation, which should be calming your nervous system. So you don't have to raise your hand, but think if that's true for you or not. So the answer is breathing and techniques of breathing and becoming aware where you feel your body blockage and then working through it. And it's not something you can necessarily just do in the moment. It's something you actually have to practice and work at so that when you can do it apart from the moment backstage, you can then, your body can learn how to do it in that moment.
This is so wonderful. By the way, take notes.
There's a test.
There's no test, but there's no recording. We didn't get permission, so we're not recording this, audio nor video. Take notes. There's a lot of this you don't want to remember. And in the future, it's like the sermon on Sunday. Hey, it was a great sermon. What was it about? You know, I don't remember, but it sure felt good when I was hearing it. You know, so that shouldn't be what this is about. To what was just said, if your entire value as a human being is threatened every time you perform, then you've got a major problem. Because that's fight or flight just off the bat. So your entire security and value system and self-worth cannot be, isn't a good singer. Now, we're affected by that. And if you know yourself, you know that you are affected by it. But that cannot be where you stay. Practically speaking, practice performing, somehow up the ante so that when you practice, somebody's there that you may not like or they might not like you, but you may be there. Here's $5, listen to you sing my aria. So.
Honey, I'm for.
Just had something brief to add to what Professor Molinari was speaking about. First of all, I think we all need to realize that it's terrifying to do what we do, and we all experience the same things we all have as we perform. But the idea that singing is by nature a calming activity is true. I think where we run into problems, as I said, is holding the breath, because as human beings, when things are difficult, we tend to make things harder. I think the most important thing is to think about what you're doing when you're not singing, when you're on stage. You know, when you're on stage, and the pianist is playing, and the orchestra's playing, and you're waiting for your entry. I holding my breath, or am I breathing as I would when I start to sing? And I think if you can begin that process of the cycle of low, relaxed, slow exhalation before the actual entrance of singing, you will enter at that moment much more confidently and successfully. I was on that concert last night and was singing some music I had learned very quickly and had some of the similar experiences thinking, I'm going to really screw this up. And I just talk myself through it, and I breathe, I had long interludes to breathe, and it went okay. Could have been better, but it went okay. So I just want to add it. Just on a pure practical level.
Do we have another question?
So, Mark, could you talk about, because you had come and done a yoga workshop last fall, and one of the things that kind of flipped me out was how to stand.
How to stand.
In other words, we tend to not stand, and the one yoga posture you use made us stand, and it felt really weird for a long period of time, but actually after there was a point at which it started to feel right. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, probably went to it right away when you stood up. Right? Notice where your feet are. Don't change anything. Notice where your feet are. Notice where the weight of your body is bearing your feet. Notice what's happening in your legs, and your knees, your hips. Notice if your weight is bearing to one side of the body, if you're favoring one side or the other. Notice where your hands are. Notice where your head is in relationship to your shoulders. Right? Notice where what's happening in the low back. If your knees are locked, what's happening in your low back? Is there congestion there, or does it feel pretty flexible and free? Good. So that's your habitual standing posture. That's the practice posture. You've done that all your life. Okay. And generally, we sing from the practice posture until we learn something different. So it might work for you, and it might not work for you, but it's worth exploring different options. So now we build a posture where we bring our feet to hip width apart. And that's anatomical structural hip width. Hip joints are about 6 or 7 inches from the center of your pelvic bone. And you bring your feet below them. And now point the toes forward so that the feet are in a perfect number 11. And now notice where the weight of your body is bearing in your feet. Interesting. Right? Notice what's happening in your knees. Can you soften, you have a micro bend of the knees, or try and lock the knees. And then notice what happens in your low back. Not fun. And then micro bend the knees, just release that, and notice that the low back releases. Now the thing that's very interesting here too is if you imagine that you're drawing your arches in an upward line, that changes something internally as well. And there's a reason for that. You have a fascia train that starts at the base of your feet. The base of your feet, the plantar fascia, there's a fascia train. The fascia is the connective tissue that brings all of your muscles, all of your joints sort of into a unified movement. And it starts at the base of your feet, comes up the inner thigh, comes into your pelvic structure, up across into the diaphragm, and ultimately up around your larynx. So you have a whole train of fascia that connects from the soles of the feet all the way up to your neck. When you raise the arches of the feet, you begin to feel a change in your breathing and your alignment internally. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a different kind of posture for singing. Is that kind of what you were talking about?
This just feels weird to me.
So this is the really important point. This is the really important point. It will feel different to you because it's not your practice posture. Your practice posture is the other one. But this can become the practice posture, and it becomes an intentional posture. So I delineate always between habitual and intentional. Habitual and intentional. And we want to practice the intentional
and begin to work out of the habitual if the habitual is not working for you.
Excellent. Thank you. Remember that.
Yes, we have scheduled other classes and everything, but I
look at that, and then I try to put in where I'm going to do it. And what musically do I need to do that's going to make me feel more comfortable when I go to my lesson and do my piece? Don't forget that if we lack in one thing and we forget to learn our music, that makes us more stressed out because we didn't learn our music, and then we're not having a good time, and everything kind of rolls. So maybe if you just think about before you go to sleep, like, this is going to be my plan for tomorrow. We really need to dig into this or work on that. And take little sections, but approach it from love. Love of what we do and love of the gift that we were given.
I think we've all got one thing to say. I'll give you two quick things. One was that, muscle memory is very powerful. So when you get ready to practice, make sure you just don't jump right in with all the stress that's built up in the day, but instead take a few minutes and do whatever you do, and if you don't have something yet, find something, there have been enough suggestions, to reset, and then practice, because if you just go in the room and frantically open that book and start singing, good things are possibly not going to happen. The other thing I want to share a quick story, and I'll pass it down. I've struggled a lot in my life with performance anxiety, and one day I was waiting to sing, and I looked out the window and I saw someone cutting the grass. This is not profound, by the way. And I thought, wow, that guy is cutting the grass. He's going to be cutting the grass when I'm done with this song in 3 or 4 minutes from now. And there's someone playing basketball. They don't care. They don't give a care in the world that I'm a wreck right here getting ready to sing. You know, I cannot tell you how much that helped me. I just calmed down and put it in perspective of life. So remember, everybody has the stress of their own lives and the joy of their own lives. We have to kind of enter the stream and exit the stream as it works for us. So just a little perspective.
I believe in the power of relanguaging things. So sometimes just when those butterflies calm or things, the heart's racing, I'll think, oh, I'm not stressed, I'm excited. There's something extraordinary about to happen. An event is about to occur. And so I believe in the power of relanguaging. But to that point, our alum, who's here, one of our alums, was visiting with me this weekend, and she has had, after several years of wonderful performing, she has gone into a degree in conflict management in higher education situations, imagine. And so anyway, she made a beautiful point to me this weekend, and Sunny, I wonder if you would share it about the difference between stress and pressure, and making that discernment and bringing mindfulness to your moment.
So this is, and I'm going to share with all of you, because this is all based on a book that was published recently called Dr. Henry Weisinger. So everyone say time to write that down. It's 22 Strategies for Pressure Relief. He believes that at the core of handling stress and pressure is determining the difference. So by his definition, and I think this so far has made sense to most people I've spoken with, stress, a stressful situation or stress is where we literally don't have the resources to get done what we need to get done, whether it's time, money, building materials, that's stress. And I'm back in grad school, I definitely got stressed. There's a lot to read, a lot to get done. Pressure, he defines as a situation we give high stakes. So we determine that something is very important, or we perceive that there's only one opportunity to get things done. And so then, when you can make the difference, you can start to address those situations in very different ways.
That's great.
That's wonderful. Thanks, Sunny. I want to go back to one of the first statements I said, and that's to find balance. And I know for me, none of us up here are stressed at all.
No.
Not at all. But I know that for me, I made a conscious choice to not have a piano at home many years ago, to not teach in my home. That when I go home, I go home. To find something else you love to do. I love to garden. I love to watch football. I like to do something that's not about singing. you know, because I want to come back to the thing I love to do. You got to step back from it and find balance in your life, and then come back to the practice room. That's
So, two things. First of all, I think this is an incredibly great question. And then two things I just want to share with you. One, a former colleague and a friend of mine.
Before that, can you tell us why you don't have socks on today?
She details from her own personal Curtis graduate the feelings that she was going through, even to the point where she was, it just created lots of conflict until she was able to separate those two. That's the first thing. And the other thing I just want to share with you, which I think about every day, I lost this incredible mentor of my life, Weston Noble, who died at 96 last year and lived this incredible life. And when he retired from Luther College, my conducting students have heard this, but when he retired from Luther College after 57 years of teaching in the same place, I asked him, he was here in the summer, we were driving out to the hotel, so I figured I'd give him a zinger. And the zinger was, so you've taught for 57 years, the best choirs in the world, what is this all about? Looked at me without hesitation, these blue eyes, and said, James, it's about one thing. And he says, I think all I've done in my life, he says, is affirm others, but most importantly, affirm myself every day. And I think that's what y'all lose sight of. You're all working so hard. And it's really difficult to take a moment. And it's not ego, it's not egocentric to love yourself and care for yourself.
It's smart.
And I think that's something I think about every day.
Along those lines, there is such thing as stress from the outside. Most of the stress we deal with is self-induced. For example, we put ourselves in situations where we're not prepared to do what we're supposed to do. As the students come in, they don't know the music or the text as it is on the page, much less how to interface with it as an artist. And then you assume that your voice is screwed up. Or maybe that you're not being taught well, or your coach didn't tell you this or teach you these notes, and really, it's your own fault. You have to prepare yourself to be able to do, otherwise, you're putting yourself in a no-win situation. You're going to disappoint yourself and take away, and if to the degree that your self-respect can be based on performance and accomplishment, and I think that's a healthy part of self-image, you're taking that away from yourself by showing up somewhere not knowing what you're going to do and thinking, uh-oh, it's just not a good day. No, that's not enough. That's just not enough. So you have to manage your time better, have to manage your energies better. This takes us to a group of questions that some of you may ask about practicing and preparing. Yes?
So this might be a segue to any question about practice, and I think Professor Ely is bringing up a fantastic point about preparation. There is a famous yogi, Patanjali Joyce, who says about yoga practice, it's 1% theory, 99% practice. So, and he also says you do your practice and everything else is revealed. So I think as in academic setting, we sometimes think of 99% theory and 1% practice.
Yeah.
And it's not. You get the 1% theory, and then 99% of the work has to be done on your own in practice. And that's where you get prepared. And it doesn't happen until you get to that level. And then within the practice is revealed the answers that you and your teacher are trying to find.
Yeah. Dr. MacArthur, and welcome Dr. Quist also.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about practice. Practice and acquiring expertise and all that is kind of a research area of mine. I'm really interested in that. And I've recently been reading the blog post of a guy named, teaches at Juilliard. His blog is called The Bulletproof Musician. Look that up. It's some really great stuff. He's got a thing going on right now with the percussionist at the Metropolitan Opera about how to prepare for auditions and being audition season for not just singers, but everybody. And it's really interesting. Yeah, where was I going? Okay, here I go. So the idea, there's a guy named Jeff Nelson who teaches at Indiana University. He's the French horn player for Canadian Brass. And he has a whole fearless audition training. And he came in and talked multiple times to the voice science class I taught there. And he says that inside of all of us, there is a technician, there is a musician, and there's a performer. Academia is really good at training your technician, which is what you and your choir director and your voice teachers are working on. And all of the theory and the history and the literature classes you take are great for working with the musician. But we don't have a lot of classes that deal directly with the performer. As you rehearse, so you perform. If you only practice technique, guess what you're going to do on stage? Technique. So you have to give yourself opportunities to actually practice performance. And there are ways to go about doing this. Check out that website, talk with your teachers about that to give you specifics. The other thing is to talk a little bit about the actual practicing process. There's a book named Outliers by a man named Malcolm Gladwell, who quite frankly bastardized the concept of deliberate practice from a guy named K. Anders Ericsson, who does research in Florida, on how you actually become an expert in any given field. Gladwell's the guy who popularized the 10,000 hour rule. The basis of that is that K. Anders Ericsson determined that in order to become an expert in any field, most experts had 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. If you take that over the course of 10 years, the 1,000 hours a year, which means 3 hours a day, for 10 years, to become an expert in any given subject, regardless of what that is. I don't know about you, but I did not do that with practicing as an undergraduate or a graduate student. So there we are. But the thing that Gladwell missed is that it's not just practice. It's not just mindless practice and repetition of going through your music. It's deliberate, focused practice. So I think the thing that's important to take away from that is you and your teacher need to figure out exactly what skills that you're doing and figure out the best way for you to practice them so that when you have a day where you are literally in classes from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night, you can find those 10 to 15 minute chunks of time to just focus on one very specific thing. Because that is literally the way the brain is wired to work. You cannot fix everything at once. It just does not happen. You literally can only think about two or three things, I think it's four actually, that you can hold in short-term memory. Everything else just goes away. So if all you're doing in your practicing is singing through your repertoire and singing through your repertoire and singing through your repertoire, you not only aren't getting better, but you're practicing getting worse. So be sure that you talk with your teachers to find very specific things to do. I didn't realize that I could practice until I was halfway through my doctorate. Don't wait that long. Talk to your teachers to figure out what you should specifically be doing in the practice to help you manage your stress so that you don't have to spend hours because the voice just can't take that. That's on. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is, when I was an undergraduate, I took a class called Relaxation and Fitness. It was basically organized nap time, which was awesome. But what I learned from that is it really is okay to take 15 to 20 minutes in the middle of a busy day just for yourselves. You don't need to feel guilty that you're not being productive in that time because your first priority is making sure that you're healthy. So if it's looking at cat videos, great. But know that that is okay. As long as you're still getting your work done, right? Okay, I'll be done.
Yes.
I kind of want to steer the subject in a different direction. I want to tell you that you should talk to your voice teachers and have them instruct you how to mark in rehearsals. how to sing, how to mark, you know, whispering doesn't necessarily save your voice, how to mark in a choral rehearsal, how to mark in your opera rehearsal or music theater rehearsal or your church choir. Talk to your teachers about that. There's an art to that. And how you can still be a contributor to the rehearsal or to your own practice, but understanding what that feels like tomorrow. Especially in the community where we are, where you're singing a lot, and you're doing lots of different types of singing. And in my opinion, that strengthens you as an individual singer, the type of singing you're doing here. But you need to know how to mark.
Excellent point, which is related to practice, and I'm hoping we have questions specifically about practice. Along those lines, we do so much singing, and if you're a voice major in any university or conservatory, you're going to do singing in various arenas. It's very easy to let your own vocal potential, your own artistic palette, be defined or limited by any number of those experiences, and you need to be in touch with your own singing and your own artistry, so that you don't let yourself be weakened or shortened or made less by any one experience. For example, if you're practicing and a lot of dramatic repertoire in your performance classes or in an opera workshop or an opera role, you need to not feel that your entire approach to singing is somehow overachieving vocally and pushing, whatever you might say. If in some of your ensemble rehearsing and other repertoire you would sing as solos, it might not stretch you in that way. You can't let yourself think, well, now my voice is represented by my voice vocally and artistically. It's represented by this repertoire. You can't let yourself be skewed in those ways. Right. So, I mean, as a baritone, and any number of you can say this, singing Mozart and Haydn masses, well, it's very easy to think, okay, I need a low E or high E, and it needs to be within this limited range. I could easily think, well, that's my voice. No, it's not. That's part of it, right? So some of your practice often, and somebody said earlier about in practicing, I think it was Professor Rice, and in short segments, you know, often, which most of us teach, go after a strenuous rehearsal, whether it's strenuous in this direction or strenuous in that direction. Go to the room for 5 minutes, just remind yourself of your voice and what your potential is, so that you don't leave it in a place that's restricted or where you're likely to push. Yes. Exactly. Good.
Hello, everybody. I just wanted to just follow up with Professor Rice was saying about marking and rehearsal as well. The nice thing about choral rehearsal, especially with the larger choirs, is that you're in it together. And if there are 20 sopranos sitting there and one of you needs to not sing that day, that is absolutely fine and a good choice for you to make. The best sounding choirs, I think, are those that are filled with healthy people. And if you are not healthy that day, not able to contribute, that is completely fine, and you should take a break and come back in when you're ready to sing. But I think that goes without saying that the primary goal of all of this is to make sure that you're approaching your life and your singing in the most healthy way possible, that is the most natural for you. And I think we would all agree on that. But the art of marking is something that you should talk to your teachers about, because I think it's tricky, and I think sometimes we do think that that's whispering or something like that, and that can actually be anti to what you're trying to do. So it's a really good point, and I think it's a really, really important one to keep in mind in all the singing that you do.
Just one thing about that? Yeah. Knowing how to mark vocally is very important, but just because we're using maybe less voice or different ways to do that, our brains are still in 150% here. That means I'm sitting there doing all the correct musical things, and the breathing, I'm still breathing like I'm listening, you know, full out, whatever. So don't think that it's just like, oh, I'm going to fluff up today and mark. No way. Because even when I was marking for rehearsals, I would warm up my voice a little bit so that I could throw the cues to my colleagues so that I could at least phonate that. But I always was really careful when I knew I was going to mark. But my brain was still 150%. So,
I think we have a question.
Hi. I have the great honor of doing a lot of collaborative projects, not just here on Westminster, but on a lot of other campuses and other communities and other projects. And because of that, I often find myself with a
quick.
Yes.
I'll quote the same book. We had the author here about 8 years ago, the author of The Practicing Mind. And he equated that type of project to, okay, I need to clean my garage. I can either open the door and look at it and go, nope, and go back in. Or I can say, I'm only going to do this corner. And then go along with my life. Then tomorrow I'm going to do the next corner. And then the next corner, and the next corner. And then you know, so planning ahead, prioritizing, knowing what's the first thing on the agenda, how to get that learned, how to get that. It's also how to, I'm sure our conductors can talk to this about how to plan a rehearsal. And when you have to get certain things done, you plan ahead instead of trying to do it all at once. It doesn't work.
And when you say beyond prioritizing, I'm not sure that's possible. I think we have to prioritize. And what I suggest is the Suzuki method. You know, when my children were taking Suzuki piano, maybe some of you all did that too. At least our teacher would have us look at movements within a song. There's no need to sing all the way through the song. There's certainly no need to always start at the beginning of the song and sing to the end. That's just a terrible idea. You always end up at the end fatigued and begin fully warmed up. So practice backwards, practice those four measures that I never get right. That's what you practice today. Another day you can integrate, or maybe integrate that 2 or 3 measures in a around it so that you can get it into the piece. But don't sing endlessly just one piece after another. It's already been said a bunch, and it's kind of a useless approach.
I have just a general statement about practice because, I mean, you have to prioritize that we can make lots of specific concepts, so techniques of practice, I'm sure some will. I think if your essential attitude is towards a stress-free, quote-unquote, attitude of physical suspension, buoyancy, interaction, having energy at your resources, as opposed to going to some different physical manipulation to make a sort of sound. Because whatever the sound is that you want to make, it shouldn't be made at the cost of manipulating your body away from the essentially connected. Balance is different. You have different goals, and so things are different. But never to the point of pressing the larynx, pulling the larynx up, tightening the jaw, pulling your tongue back, etc., locking your abs. I mean, all those things that we know are not part of a suspended and buoyant musical body. So if your preference is towards that body attitude, that's predominant. Also, the kind of practice we do, those of you for the 2 or 4 or 6 years that you're essentially learning how to sing, that becomes an even more delicate question. Because you're supposed to be building a relationship with your voice, your body, yourself, your spirit, how to sing, that will serve you from now on in a lot of ways. I mean, the biggest part of that building time is why you're here. So don't disadvantage that process by trying to practice too many things all at the same time.
I want to add to that what I think a challenge is, and that is practicing synthesis. I think one of the most challenging things we as artists face is the putting together the pieces. We spend our lives dwelling in these nuggets, dwelling in these pieces and pages and moments, and then we're shocked when we go to perform at how fatiguing it is, not verbally, but so much as it is physically and intellectually and spiritually to stay present in the moment. So for my students, I encourage them at the 5 minutes at the end of every session, even if they've just worked on half a piece, that they run that. And that you run that practicing stamina and practicing synthesis. I think you can't wait for the muse to visit us regarding that. But that we need to find a time every day where we practice some version of the whole and putting it all together.
Great. Oh, what? Yes?
Yeah, it says uh-oh. You know, it's so easy with all we have to do, whether it be loads and loads of music to learn or think about the technique you're trying to acquire or the languages you're trying to learn, or the theory or homework you have to do, not that you have to get overwhelmed. It's so easy to get overwhelmed, and I think that it's so important to find the joy in the process and not be focused on the destination all the time. And if you have this much music to learn, focus on where you are at that moment and just enjoy that. You know, be in the now, be in the moment, and enjoy. Find something, it's like Nova said about relanguaging, right? Find the thing that's difficult and say, why is this challenging to me and why do I enjoy trying to make this better? What is wonderful about making this sound? Well, my mix files are horrible. Rieger tells me all the time. So, instead of looking at it that way, say, well, it's fun to do this. Look how much more expressive I can be when I make these sounds. So I don't know. I watch my wife teaches violin and lots of young students, and I watch how she works with them. And she'll do things like circle the large spot and call it practice bubble. And when they get it right, they get to pop the bubble. And it's so cute, right? But I think for all of us, we have to keep that kind of joy, that kind of... Don't forget why you did this in the first place. You know, we all decided to do this not because, you know, we're going to get rich doing it. We did it because we loved it.
Questions? We have time for one or two more. Or more specific answers about how to practice certain things. So, yes, question.
You are bad. So every time I think it's important to go back, like I think you said,
And what was it that Weston said to reaffirm yourself?
Affirm
yourself every day, and that means you go back to your team. Very small team of people who understand who you are as an artist. I can say really quickly that our alum, who got both of her degrees here, Kira Duffy, is featured in our interviews this month. And the first time she was heard here on this campus by somebody from the Met, she was told, it's really nothing very special, nothing special. And you know, our first reaction was, why, And then we went back and said, well, wait a minute, let's find out what is special about you. And put that out, put that product out there, instead of trying to put out the same repertoire, the same thing over and over again. So sometimes I think being told no gives you a good chance to go back and reevaluate.
I'll say something about that. I know last spring, I read an interesting article about how to assess an audition, and when I find it, I can give it to you. But I remember rereading notes I took on it, and it's talked about when we review our performances, we can review it from the standpoint of, oh, I'm really terrible, why didn't I do well, you know, an emotional response. And then we can also review a performance from just a mere factual thing, like, well, how was I feeling that day? How exactly did I practice? And I think for those auditions where things didn't go the way you wanted to go, and not speaking of they didn't like me, but I knew I wasn't working at my top level, you might be very factual and see, did I really prepare that piece well? Did I really know the language? Have I really worked out the breathing issues in that piece? But go from a more fact base. And then this article also went on to say that when we do a stunning performance, that's the one where you need to say, I am the best baloney in the business.
Yes.
I will tell you something very personal. You know, my background was as a keyboard person, not necessarily as a singer, and then I became a singer-writer. And it was quite a feat for me to get up from being behind an organ bench to getting up in front of people singing. But I did it because I loved it. I always told my classmates I was a closet singer. But I remember some time ago on the faculty, I gave a recital, and I was really psyched for this recital. It was a program of music that I loved. I know I did everything I needed to do to make this right, and I'd be practicing, of course, in my studio, which is a very visible place, and people would say, was that you singing? You know, it was beautiful, we can't wait for your recital. So I was psyched. Saturday night comes, I walk out on that stage, place was filled. I started my opening group, and the whole time I was singing, I thought, I am not going to make it through this recital. What is wrong with my voice? Nothing felt right. So I had that first group, that's all I was thinking of. And it was a group that was not very demanding vocally, and I chose it for that reason. It was all Italian. And then I knew the next group I had was the Liszt Petrarch sonnets, which this man next to me sang brilliantly a few years ago, and I'm glad you weren't there. And then I remembered a workshop here from Laura, help me her name, to the Shirley Emmons and the sports psychologist.
What's her name?
No.
Don
Green. No.
Oh, I know. I can't remember her name, but I know.
This is what happened. Yeah. And I remember her coming here and talking to us. And she had worked with Luciano Pavarotti. She originally was a sports psychologist and then went into singing. And I remember listening to her and she said, you know, it's so funny, I worked with him and I went to a performance and he sounded beautiful. And then he didn't like one note and he thought the performance was terrible. And in sports, you know, we always, when something good happens, that's what we dwell on. Of course, it was a high C, and she didn't realize that that is very important to most of us singing. But she said, singers, you know, if something goes wrong, keep thinking positive things. If you sing a phrase well, congratulate yourselves. And for some reason, that came into my mind. And I got through that performance. I sang some pretty difficult literature. I don't think it was my best singing ever. And I'll be honest with you, I've yet to listen to the recording. But I knew I had still performed and did something artistic that night. And some of my colleagues and friends who knew me say, gee, we could tell you weren't in your top game, but you really gave an artistic performance. So it's that congratulating yourselves every time. But the fact they sing might help the audition. Thank you.
this has been such a wonderful time. I'd like for us all to stand. We want to applaud you. I invite you to applaud the panel. Stand. Thank you, Ms. Bassett. Oh, this is going to be awesome.